Hi, I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. This week, we're very excited to bring you a special Halloween-themed bonus episode of The Treatment, an interview with horror film director William Lustig. It was recorded live at the Bing Theater as part of the Film Independent at LACMA film series, for which Elvis is the curator. The conversation took place in between a double feature of Lustig's 1980 slasher classic Maniac, starring Joe Spinell, and Vigilante, starring Robert Forster. A warning that this conversation contains explicit material.
It's funny, we were talking so many times since I've known you. That was such an interesting period for movies. First of all, just seeing what Times Square looked like in 1979.
It does bring tears to your eyes, doesn't it?
It really does. And who's that young man who said, "Are you staying for the continental breakfast?"
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's what happens with age. I was 24 when I was sitting there. Oh, God. It's called dying on film.
Was that line improvised, by the way? Or?
Yes. Well, yes, that was all improvised. Most of the movie was improvised. One of the hardest parts of that was Joe with his straight face writing all kinds of silly things to me on that card that he's doing this sign, and I would keep cracking up. And so the hardest part was doing it without laughing.
Well, you seem to be kind of laughing in the shot anyway, which is the fun of it. But it's,
I guess.
I have to tell you that, and before we get into so many questions I have about this movie, but that poster is, the greatest piece of movie art of the last half of the 20th century. It really is. I mean, everybody I know...
I don't think the MPA would agree with you.
Yes, tell me a story about the MPAA's reaction to that.
Well,
first of all, tell about how that poster come to be, because it's a pretty daring piece of poster art.
Well, the guys who distributed Maniac in the States, there were these partners, Paul Cohen and Robert Kaplan. They had a company called Analysis Film Corporation, which was kind of the Miramax of its day. They were releasing movies like My Brilliant Career, Mephisto, Luchino Visconti's movies. Along comes Maniac, and they wanted this picture. They topped every offer we had for the film. They screened it. They loved it. They wanted the picture and paid us a very handsome amount of money for it. So now it came time to marketing the film, and because they paid so much money, you don't really have that much input. You know, when the man puts his money down, you know, they kind of run with it. So they call me into their office one day. Now you have to understand, this is 1980, Studio 54. See if I could draw the picture. Their office was an office / coke den.
You've drawn the picture pretty well with that.
You know, think mini Scarface. Every time I'd go into their office, they'd be eating sushi and doing lines of coke on their desks. And I think it was during one of these sessions that they somehow came up with this poster. And they brought me into their office, and, you know, I was a totally straight guy. I didn't do drugs or anything. Spinell, of course, used to love to go up. Bill, I'm going to go to the distributor to discuss marketing. But, you know. Anyway, so they called me in one day to show me the first draft of the poster, and I went into shock. And they're looking at it, and they're thinking, like, this is the greatest. And I'm looking. I didn't know what to think. There never had been a poster like the one for Maniac.
Ever.
So when you're seeing something that's so in your face, something that you never have seen before, you don't know exactly how to react.
What did you think when you saw the line?
Okay, what they were doing was arguing with the ad agency about wanting to accentuate the erection.
Yes, the boner in the pants.
Yeah, the boner in the pants. They're over there going, can't we just see just a little bit more of the erection near the knife? And I'm over there going, I can't believe this. Well, you know, that had many connotations.
Just that line alone in the poster, to have that line and the erection near the knife with the gut spilling out and the head and the blood over the shoes.
Well, you know, you have to understand, this was the time of, I hate to use the word, woman's lib, you know, that was the period.
I would say the beginning of enlightenment.
Yeah, the
women.
Enlightenment. This was the period.
I'm here to help.
And there were all these, there was all these, that's what it was called back then. And there was all these there was such a tremendous backlash against movies like Halloween, Friday the 13th. They were looked upon as, you know, really, you know, they looked at as being like, you know, misogynist movies, and that perfect. And Maniac, of course, epitomized all of them. And that poster just like infuriated them, so that there were protests all across the country, from L.A., New York, Philadelphia. I have all the news clips to prove it, but they went nuts all over the country, and the MPA was like, this is it. And what they did from that point on is they began raiding posters, which had never been done before. Before, you just submitted your movie to the MPAA, but what happened with Maniac is it caused them to begin rating. You had to submit your advertising and your posters and everything as part of your rating. And I have to take credit for that.
Mr. May I say thank you right now? Can we please, Mr. Bill Lustig?
But it was so, yeah. But it was so funny that they kept the poster in their office and they would actually show it to people. Like, this is everything we don't want to see.
Well, congratulations for condensing
it. And I'm friends with them at the MPAA in Sherman Oaks. Oh, yeah, no, I would go in there because I would have to rate my movies. I would go, let me tell you a little thing I used to do with the MPAA. Before video, what I used to do is you would submit it to them on 35-millimeter film. And what I would do is, like in the case of Vigilante, and I think I did this on Relentless as well, is they would always come back on my movies X, always X. So what I would do is I'd go in and I would chop the film up, but I wouldn't remove any frames, so that when it would get to a scene that was disturbing to them, it would run through the projector. They had no frame, they had no reference because it was before video, and all they would see was all these tape marks and splice marks and everything in the violent scenes, and they thought, oh, we cut it down. It's been removed.
Got a few frames.
And pff, you know, it was exactly what they had seen before, except it was defaced. And this was the game I played with them. I'm past the statute of limitations. So.
Well, you know, and it's now officially art, not you deface the film. But one of the things I think people should know about Joe Spinell is that even though he seems like a seedy kind of, basically kind of guy who'd be a maniac, he got his start as a teenager at the public theater. Because he grew
yes.
up, he was a teenager when Joe Papp opened the first public theater in the Lower East Side.
Exactly. He worked in, La Mama?
Yeah.
And he worked at, there was a theater for the Forgotten, which was a theater that went around to prisons. New York City prisons, and he found a lot of prisoners who he helped get into the film business as actors. There was a guy, Richard Ferrangi, comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Remember Richard Ferrangi?
Yeah.
I think he's still around. Richard Ferrangi was one of them, and there were others. Tony Sirico.
Yeah. He was a gangster, absolutely.
Yeah. The real deal. Paulie Walnuts
from The Sopranos.
The Sopranos. And Joe was like the guy who got them in. Danny Aiello was driving a bus, and he helped Danny Aiello get in to Godfather 2.
Yeah, it's because people, basically, he kind of grew up in the story not dissimilar to this, with a really sort of strong-willed mom, and would go to the public theater and just hung around, and Joe Papp finally went, okay, come on, I'll give you a shot. He was like 16 or 17 when he started the public theater.
Yeah, Joe grew up in theater, and he was loved. He was truly loved. Everybody who worked with him loved him. Even, you know, when... I tell the story about on Godfather 1, he was second to Marlon Brando. He was one of the highest paid actors in the show because Francis Coppola kept him around and he was being paid as a day player. And so it racked up a lot of money. This is before computers. So nobody really realized how much money he was making until he had made a quite a bit of money on Godfather 1. But, you know, he was a loved guy.
I really want to say this, too, because it shows in his performance. I mean, you gave him a chance to do something. I mean, people would see him in the Godfather movies.
Oh,
yeah. Or they would see him in Rocky. But every filmmaker knew him and loved him because no matter how he looked, he was a serious actor. He took the craft very seriously.
He was very serious about his craft.
But talk about how you met him and how this all came to happen.
Well, I mean, I met Joe. I was working... it was at the Phil D'Antoni office. Remember Phil D'Antoni? He produced Bullet, The French Connection.
Because you got one of the French Connection cops in the movie.
They were all there. And And Joe and I hit it off because I loved horror films, and he loved horror films. And we would talk about our favorite horror films all the time. And, of course, you know, when horror people meet, they bond, you know. And Joe and I bonded.
I know this very well, yes.
And over the years, we talked about it. I began making adult movies, and he was going off to Rome doing movies and all over the world, and he would come to New York. I was on the set of Taxi Driver when he was doing that with Scorsese, and I was really determined, and Joe was determined to support me in it, and we were going to find a horror film that he would star.
How old were you when you met him?
I was about probably around 18, 19.
Wow.
Yeah.
Under what circumstance? How did that happen?
As I said, it was through Phil D'Antoni.
Just being at the office. So were you working as were you a PA there,
I was
an intern?
PA, okay, work that's what with, I with Phil D'Antoni and all that. And it was.
But you knew at that point you were going to direct a movie, even then?
You know, it's funny. Yeah. I knew in high school. I mean, I knew I wanted to make movies.
Because just the idea of somebody who didn't go to film school, didn't do any of that kind of stuff, just being in an office and seeing this happen and saying, I wanted to do this, was kind of a unique thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it is, and it's probably a little crazy, but I was determined to make movies. I remember being in high school saying, why are they keeping me here? I want to go out and make movies. That's what I wanted to do. That's all I ever wanted to do. I had a very simple plan. It was to make movies.
So you talked with Joe, and then he and his partner went off and wrote the script, right?
Well, C.A. Rosenberg, here's what happened. We had this idea for Maniac. We actually had developed other scripts. But finally, we realized we couldn't raise the money to make the other films we wanted to make, one of which was very similar to the Jennifer Lynch movie that's around right now called Chained. It was a very similar movie. It's based on the same the movie Chained is loosely based on a real life case in New Jersey, which is what Joe and I were working on. It was about a father son serial killer team. Anyway, but it's a true story, and so anyway, getting back to it to Maniac. What happened is Joe did a lot of research about serial killers. He would read everything. You know, keep in mind the 70s were the golden age of serial killers in this country. We could be proud of that. We had Ted Bundy. We had Henry Lee Lucas.
I don't even know if you're in a museum where I want to say golden age, but okay, but I know what you mean.
We had we had really colorful, kind of fun, interesting serial killers in this country. You know, now they're boring. Now they're like this, you know, guy next door, you know, some white trash guy. He buried a girl in the backyard. He has no personality.
He's no Richard Speck, is that
what you're saying? He's just boring. I mean, no Ted Bundys are around now who, you know, these guys are just boring. I mean, I was trying to explain. I was in Spain last week, and I was trying to explain.
At Sitges, what happened to you?
I was there for the Maniac remake screening.
But what else happened with Sitges?
What happened?
Didn't they basically sort of like put you on the jury too? Weren't you on the jury?
Oh yeah, they put me on the jury there. That was kind of a mistake, but that's another story. Well, I didn't realize what I was in for, but it was. I tried to explain about the love that our country has for people who are I'll give you an example. I tried to explain to them about the iPhone app called Offender Locator. Try to explain that to people in Europe, you guys have that offender locator on your iPhone.
Explain for those who don't have what it is.
Well, let me put it to you this way. The neighborhood that both you and I share in the East Village was not like little red dots, but one big red blotch. And that's what I would, anyway, so getting back to this, Joe had come up with this idea of doing a compilation of all these people. And we handed it off. There was a guy named Richard Rosenberg, who was a writer of TV crime movies. His wife was an aspiring writer. Richard couldn't do it, but his wife would do it, and Richard would kind of work with her. Okay. And so they wrote a script, which was really a conventional cops chasing a serial killer movie. That's what it was. There was a detective in the movie that was going to be played by Jason Miller, and it was entirely an entirely different script. Well, as it turned out, we're trying to find a way to make the movie. And as things happened, which really worked for our benefit, we had to pare the movie down. Jason Miller dropped out. We realized we didn't, you know, we just didn't have, we had basically $48,000 to shoot the movie. That's what we had, $48,000. We had to shoot the movie in 16 millimeter, beg, borrow, and steal everything. And, you know, and we were determined to do it for 48, and we had $48,000. We knew that couldn't get the film finished, but at least we would get the, what I would call the train would leave the station. Because when the, when in the film business, if the train leaves the station, that's the only time you can get people to jump on board. If you sit around and you wait for everything, or if you wait for that perfect picture and everything is in place, it will never happen.
It's the difference between saying you're going to make a film and making a film.
Exactly. It's one day you got to kind of put the stake in the ground saying we're going to go out and start shooting. Sure. And there was a window of opportunity with Joe, and he even turned down a job. He turned down a supporting role in the Spielberg Zemeckis film, Used Cars, because he was committed to doing Maniac.
A much better choice doing this, obviously.
Right. So now we had the problem that we had $48,000. We couldn't do the movie SAG. Well, there's a little-known thing, and Joe being a high-profile SAG actor,
of course,
we were stuck in a position where he couldn't give up his livelihood, you know. So there was a little clause in the SAG contract, which was put in there because of a producer making a porn film that was SAG, using SAG actors, and actually it was called Sometimes Sweet Susan.
That was a
SAG porno film. In fact, he even put it in the advertising for whatever reason. I can't imagine what erotic value
that gives. So they could get like SAG award nominations for it.
But the idea was at the time these movies were supposed to have an air of legitimacy, and he put that it was a Screen Actors Guild picture in the advertising and the publicity for the film. Well, SAG, of course, went nuts, and like any kind of organization, you know, that goes nuts, they come up with a bylaw. Oh, we have no jurisdiction over adult movies. We will not have any jurisdiction over adult movies. So then you couldn't become a SAG signatory. So we scratched our heads, and Joe and I sat around my kitchen table and came up with a script for Maniac that we said was surefire X-rated. We put things in there you wouldn't believe. So now we send off the script. We had all kinds of things in there. So you name it, it was the most depraved script. It was everything you saw, but embellished for the purpose of the
embellishment was missing from this movie.
Right, exactly. So what happened is I get a call from John Sook. I'll never forget his name, the president of SAG in New York. And they just immediately said, this is not going to be a SAG movie. Perfect. So now we can have SAG actors on our movie and not make it a SAG movie. So Joe wouldn't get into trouble and we wouldn't have to worry. Because remember, again, we had to make this film for $48,000. We had to get this thing shot. So we, you know, these are the things you have to do. And so that's what happened. So that's.
I mean, because you're talking about that, but in light of that makeup effect you're talking about, you happen to have a basically prosthetic genius very early in his career who gave you a scene that people are still talking about, that shotgun blast.
Well, actually, what's funny about the shotgun blast, it is the simplest effect in the world because we actually fired a live shotgun on the streets of New York right next to a major highway, was right behind. That was not a studio, which it could have easily have been. I mean, looking at it, you don't see any background yet. We shot it on the location near the Verrazano Bridge with the BQE behind us with cars passing. And we had a double load 12-gauge shotgun. And it was fired by Tom Savini into his own head. That's how he got the role, because he had a dummy head of himself already made. And he was, and also, just to give a little thing, he was planning to get nose surgery. So he knew that he couldn't use this dummy head in the future after his nose surgery. So we shot the scene So Tom became the actor in the scene because we had the head for him. You know, it's all these practical reasons why you do things. And he fired the head. He fired the shotgun into the head. If you look very carefully, we were using this fog machine, which had this oil that came out of it, and it would spread around where the area where the fog is. So the hood of the car became kind of like all oily from this fog machine. So when you look at it carefully again, you'll see that the force of the of firing the shotgun into a real windshield, not a breakaway windshield, but a real windshield, caused him to go with, have his feet come out from under him, and he went flying backwards, and we weren't prepared for it, so there was no mattress or anything on the ground. So poor Tom landed on the sidewalk and on the cement at the at, you know, in front of the car. All I cared about was we just fired a live shotgun. I had a PA, what I call one of my sacrificial lamb PAs. I had him standing by with a, with his car with the trunk open. To, I grabbed the shotgun out of Tom's hands, bring it over to the trunk of the car, put throw it in the trunk, close the lid. I tell the PA, drive to New Jersey.
Well, when you put it that way, it does sound like a really simple way to stage the effect.
Exactly. It was all kind of it. And then I later came back to Tom to see if he was okay. But I didn't. At that moment, all I knew was if anybody called the police, I didn't want to have a live smoking shotgun on the set. I just wanted out of there.
Before I ask you a question about the song Maniac, I do want to talk about Vigilante a little bit.
Sure.
And all, the one thing that kind of runs through your movies is basically people being on odd sides of the law,
uh-huh.
either through Maniac Cop or Relentless or Vigilante or Maniac.
Elvis, it's called conflict.
Tell
that's
me
what it's called.
It's conflict of which you speak.
It's conflict. You have good guys, you have bad guys. You know, that's what...
But you basically have... what they used to call, back in the days of women's lib, anti-heroes in your
True.
Movie.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, guys, and there is no real order for them to be up against. I mean, so that's something that you're really attracted to as a filmmaker.
I guess. I guess you could see that. I don't really think about it, but I, of course, I'm always, I'm attracted to, you know, things like that, you know.
I mean, just these
turning the world upside down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we see it really in Vigilante, a guy who's basically questioning the law, who ends up being on... inside and outside of prison and figuring out his place in that world.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about Vigilante, it was loosely based on a vigilante group that was formed, I believe it was either in Philadelphia or lower New Jersey near Philadelphia. And again, what I did was I wanted to do a kind of a Death Wish movie, but in the mode of a spaghetti western. And so that's what I tried to do with Vigilante, is try to make it a kind of a spaghetti western, an urban spaghetti western. And I mean, that was the...
But you talk about spaghetti western, but you have a guy who basically could be the Franco Nero character in Robert Forster's character.
In fact, you want to hear something funny.
What's that?
The Vigilante was a big success in Europe. And particularly in Italy, it was like on, it was charted like on way up on the top of the charts. It was a theatrical hit in Italy, and sure enough, I was very proud of this because in many ways my influence for Vigilante came out of Italy. You know, both with the spaghetti westerns and all of their French Connection, Death Wish,
all those Italian police,
yeah, all those
in
Italian
early 70s.
Crime movies that were wonderful period of Euro crime films in the '70s. There's a documentary you should screen here called Eurocrime. It's fantastic.
Okay.
the Italians would make sequels to or make remakes of American movies without obtaining the rights. So they made Vigilante 2, starring Franco Nero, directed by Enzo Castellari.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I was so proud of that. I have the video jacket on my wall and Franco Nero. And here's another coincidence in L.A. Robert Forster and Franco Nero live in the same condo building with and their condos are on the same floor within like 10 feet of each other.
That's a great story. Yeah. I've got to ask you, because we're running out of time here, the story about the Michael Cimbello song from Flashdance, Maniac, in its original incarnation.
Yes. Well, Joe had a thing while we were making Maniac. Bill, we need to put a song in the movie. We need to put a song in the movie. And I would hear this over and over again, and he was like determined that he wanted so badly. It was like he was on a mission to have a song in the film. I go, Joe, a song in a movie like Maniac is totally ridiculous. He goes, really, Bill? You think it's any more ridiculous than Michael Jackson singing to a rat?
The Oscar-nominated song from the movie Ben. That's
right. So he was going, you know, we can make more money from that song than we could from the movie. So anyway, so we never put a song in Maniac. Okay, so cut to a few years later, Flashdance comes out, big success. The song Maniac is all over the radio, you know, music videos, everything else. I get a call from Joe. You know, Bill, that song was made, it was inspired by our movie. And I go, and now Joe, you know, had, you know, he sometimes got a little delusional. Not always, but there were times. So anytime he would say things to me, I go, yeah. And I knew, I thought he was doing it to rub it into me, that we didn't put a song in the movie, that we could have had the song Maniac in the movie Maniac. And it was his way of like, you know, yeah, you passed up a fortune. So about, oh God, probably about 25 years later, sometime like in the, in I think it was around 2000, let's say 2005 or something. I'm watching VH1. Never watch VH1. I'm sitting in my apartment watching VH1, and they have a show called One Hit Wonders. On the show is Michael Cimbello, and they're interviewing him about the song Maniac. And what they tell and what he says is, yeah, blah 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 blah. And we were inspired by a movie called Maniac, and they all of a sudden cut to the poster of the movie. And I go, oh my God. Joe wasn't kidding. It's true. So so now
the lyrics are about dismemberment and attack. I mean, because I told you, I actually, a friend of mine gave me a copy of that original version, and it's a horrifying song.
Right, I know. So what happened is we're getting ready, several years later, I'm getting ready to put out a new edition of Maniac, a special edition. Yet another special edition, I should say, a specialer edition, and I decided I want to research this. So I contact Michael Cimbello, who lives near Philadelphia, and he confirmed that that was true, and he was very amenable to being interviewed, and he had somebody he wrote it with, who lived out of town, who was going to come to the New York area. Anyway, cut to the chase. I go to Philadelphia, I shoot an interview with the two guys who wrote the song, and they performed the song as it was originally written. Now, I don't remember all the lyrics, but it went something like, he's a maniac, he will kill your cat and nail him to your door, and it went on, and what happened is
but one of the chorus, I mean, one of the bridge lines, it stays in the original song, but it's just changed the gender chain. In the real-time world, no one sees him at all.
Yeah.
They all think he's crazy. That's in the original version.
Oh, yeah.
Song.
Oh, they all think he's crazy. She's crazy. He's crazy. It was male thing. Anyway, what happened was one of the music producer for Flashdance heard the song and said, look, we want it for the movie if you change the lyrics. And that's how it wound up in Flashdance. But I can't believe that Joe knew that.
And so you can say that indirectly you were responsible for an Oscar nomination for 2 weeks because they took the nomination back once they found out the origin of the song.
Well, not only did I not make any money, but according to the guys who wrote it, they made a pittance compared to what the song actually
wrote it and performed it, by the way.
And performed it, sold it outright to Paramount. And unfortunately, they were one-hit wonders. And
well, obviously you weren't. But I have one final question about both the movies. Tell me about the first time you saw Maniac, because it must have played in the area in which you shot the opening sequence.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like the very first time you saw it there?
Well, of course, when the movie opened, the only theater I wanted to see it at, I immediately ran to 42nd Street because I knew that was do or die. If the audience played there, I knew I had a winner. And so I immediately went to 42nd Street, brought my camera, photographed the marquee. I was so proud that I had my first picture playing on 42nd Street. Oh, by the way, a 42nd Street story. I'm waiting for a thank you from Steven Spielberg because the film you're about to see, Vigilante, played as the second feature for E.T. in New York. And played there for months on 42nd Street. So I always tried to imagine the family who was going, honey, let's get the kids and go see E.T. and Vigilante. But it's true, and I got the pictures to prove it.
Those kids are still in therapy
and
today.
And I probably helped E.T. a little bit on the deuce, and I never got a thank you from Spielberg. Can you help me with that, Elvis?
Let me make a couple of calls. That's the greatest story I ever heard. But where the no? Go back to. I'm sorry. Seeing Maniac for the first time on 42nd Street, you said you had played there.
Well,
you knew.
You have to understand the audience in New York really responds to movies. It's not like over here where you get a gasp, you get a polite applause. Over there, if the movie sucks, they let you know it. And I remember during the movie, you'd hear things like, "Bitch, don't close your eyes. I paid for that. You know, open your eyes, watch the movie, watch the movie, watch the." You know, you hear things like that. I mean, 42nd Street was great. You know, when Vigilante played, there's a scene where Robert Forster is thrown into Rikers. This will really show you how comforting it is to watch a movie there. There's a scene in Vigilante where Robert Forster is thrown into prison, and we actually filmed it in the real Rikers Island prison. We got into Rikers Island prison, and we shot Bob Forster when he's entering the prison. What was funny, when I saw that on 42nd Street, one of the people in the audience going, "I was there. That was where I was. That's where my cell was." That's a, you know, it really makes you want to.
I'm so glad we're doing this Q&A in the museum. let me ask you about meeting Bob Forster for the first time, who's a very different guy from Joe. What was that like, the first thing you talked
about?
Well,
Bob is the sweetest, nicest guy in the world. We had another actor that we had been in discussions with, and I think it would be okay to tell his name, Tony Muzzanti.
Oh, sure.
And for various reasons, we decided that we had to make a change, and we decided to look for a replacement. And my friend Frank Pesch frequented a bar that Bob Forster frequented in L.A. and suggested Bob Forster. And I love Bob. I mean, I had just seen him in Alligator, and I just think Bob is the greatest. And we called him up, and we hired him, and he was shooting the movie a week or two later. And it's one of the few actor friendships that I've maintained. Most times you're kind of ships, you know, passing in the night. And Bob has been someone who I've maintained a true friendship with over the years. And he's a really, really great guy. And I mean, you know, he was in the trenches with us when we were running out of money on Vigilante. And, you know, SAG requires certain, you know, dressing rooms and things like that. I finally had to say to Bob one day, "Yes, where do I change?" I said, "You see that Gulf station on the corner? Ask for the key to the men's room." And he laughed and did it.
Well, I can think of no better way to introduce Vigilante than by paying tribute to the devotion of the man who was stars in the movie and of the director. Let's thank Bill Lustig for being here.
Thank you for coming.
Tonight.